What a motley crew. I'm not an alcoholic. I wish that Al hadn't emphasized old-timer. Will you help me become an old-timer? My sobriety date, in case you wanted to, I'll give a damn. All right. It's 11-11-1960. Now, to bring it back to reality, one of the areas from the time that I first met you folks in 1953 to 1960 was the worst hell that I've ever lived in my life before I got sober. Is there any guy in the world winos in here? Let's see. God, you people haven't lived yet. Jesus. Well, I'm Cherokee, member of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. There's four of us boys and two girls. My idol that I idolized as a young person died of alcoholism and convulsion in Fort Worth, Texas, in jail. Needless to say that my age kind of puts me back in my teen years in the 30s. That makes a lot of you people not even being here. Times were pretty damn tough in those years. And I think to some of you folks that understand what I'm talking about, the depression days. I tell this to different groups of people that I work with every now and then. That we work for $1 a day. That my brother that I idolized, he had a $15 a week job. That was before 8 hours. That was when everybody worked from the time that they went to work until they got off. I idolized this man because he had money. And during the Depression days, there wasn't too many people that weren't crooks that didn't have money. So he was, he had some girls working for him, and I don't mean waitresses. And he had a little bootleg thing going on and some floating crap games. But he walked around with a roll of bills where the rest of the people were working their ass off for $12-$15 a week. And I said, that's the kind of a guy I want to idolize right there. But little did I know that this man was an alcoholic. We used to call him Sots. My whole family on the mother's side, at least, was some of the old vets from World War I, the old boatswain mates, and they were, all of my uncles were drunks. I mean, real drunks. And I watched their behavior, and I think, like most of us in this room, that we would never become like them. And little did I know that was going to transpire as time went on. This brother of mine that I'm telling you about, he had, in those days he had pinstripe suits and patent leather shoes and wore a little vest, and he always had a little 25 automatic in one of the vest pockets. And I used to watch him, and he'd shoot you. I mean, he'd get about half a shot on that not right gun booze back in Oklahoma. And he'd fight. I mean, he just didn't give a damn, it didn't seem like. And I was finding out I was a little bit too chicken for that kind of stuff. But when I had a couple of bottles of booze in me, why, it didn't make any difference. I started out pretty young. I think when you look at it in my younger life, to tell you folks something about riding freight trains all over the United States when I was 14 years old, it's almost incomprehensible to a lot of people. But in those days during the Depression, there was that the railroads and the highways were full of kids my age all over the country. Not going anywhere, not coming anywhere or nothing, just there. So I'll tell you about a little story about my first trip away from home when I was 14 years old. I lived in Muskogee in Oklahoma. And I met this guy up at a railroad station there in Muskogee. And I said, where are you going? He said, don't make any difference. I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I'm going north or south." And he said, we had a sack of blue durum and a nickel. So we said, we flipped it and says, L.A. tails, New York City head. Well, L.A. won, so here we go. This was probably one at 14 years old. I realize it today to see kids at 14. Most of them are dope heads that I run into. And the thing that transpired was he had experience on the railroad, and he was built about like Albert there. Not quite. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is he was a strong young man. And when we would get tied up with the guys that had a little money, or a little bit gay, why, he could knock one of them out in one punch, and I tried it, and I couldn't do it, you know. So I'd just mess the guy's face up, and he had to come by and finish, and we'd rob him, take what we got, to get on the train or hitchhike or something. And what was happening in those days, a bottle of rubbing out, not rubbing alcohol, it was a liniment called bay rum. Anybody know what bay rum is? Well, Bob knows, yeah, he probably soaked on it. Now this bay rum was about 20-25% alcohol, and it cost a nickel a bottle. So that's pretty easy to steal. And we headed out from Muskogee down to Fort Worth, Texas. We was going to make our trip to Los Angeles. He said, "I know how to go under the fence here," and it was about a 20-foot drop, but we got a little path. He knew where all the stand stuff was. And we got up there, and there was a whole bunch of hobos lined up. They had the immigration and police were standing there, and here was the train right there that was going to go. And he said, "Well, we're going to wait until they give the highball." So it gives the highball, and he said, "Let's go." I said, "What do you mean, through all them people?" He said, "I mean right through all them people." So I'm this little skinny kid, and I'm running through there, and he grabbed the freight train, and he grabbed it, and I heard some splattering going on around my head, you know. And I said, "What the hell is that?" He said, that's a man shooting at us. So we get on this train, and we go out to West Texas, and little town of Torrey, Texas. And it was really, these are good experiences I want to go along with you, because it leads up to something. Well, anyway, there was about 300 people on this train after it got out to this, what they used to call a substation. And they stopped in a little town. See, those were steam engines. Anybody know what a steam engine is in here? Some of you don't. Anyway, they had to get water to make steam, so they had to stop. Well, these hobos jumped off, including us, in this little tiny town. Well, there was gardens all over the place, man. There were potatoes and corns and tomatoes and stuff, and these hobos hit them and jumped off this train and started digging potatoes up and taking all the tomatoes off them people's vines, taking their clothes off the clotheslines. And here come the sheriff down, and he told his train master, he said, "Stop the next goddamn train and get these people out of my town." So that was the setting. That was pretty well the setting of my young life. And it carried on for quite a few years until Pearl Harbor. And I was a little bit too young for Pearl Harbor, but right after Pearl Harbor, I went in the Army. And done my duty down in the Pacific. And I had a brother that was down there also. But anyway, the family that I come from, my Cherokee family, was a very loose-knit type of a family. There was very little discipline in my life at the time. One of the reasons I think a lot of men in this room, a lot of men that I know as alcoholics, have trouble with their fathers. But my dad didn't know how to punish you. He knew how to beat you, but he didn't know how to punish you. And we had a front room. And he had a razor strap. You know, the old timers had them razors. He had a razor strap hanging up by the window in the little old pan where he shaved. And when Dad said, I want to see you in the front room, and you grabbed that razor strap, you started peeing in your pants right then. Because you were going to get the hell beat out of him. So I said, I'm not going to take any more of this crap. So at 14, I'm out of there. Not knowing where in the hell to go, not what to do or anything else, but I wasn't going to take it anymore. And later on in my story, it's a very integral part of the way that I felt. Because little did I know that all of the things that I had done in my life was part of my feelings that later on I would run into. I repressed an awful lot in my life, the things that I've seen and things that I've done. And it wasn't until you got me into these 12 steps that I started to bring out some of this stuff, because my behavior, and I think that was one of the worst things in my life, was my behavior that I could not change. I knew I didn't want to be like I was, but I could not change to anything else. And I think that we know that's one hell of a predicament to be in. And the only way that I could ever stop that would be to lose it up and to not feel. But at the same time, I think this is one of the axioms of being an alcoholic, is that we know that we're wrong. See, that is, a lot of people said, I didn't know what was wrong with me. Well, you might have didn't know what he's talking about on his research about what was wrong with you. But I don't think anybody in this world, unless you're some kind of a real nut, that didn't know that when you drink whiskey, you're going to get in trouble. See? Yeah. Some people's stories go along and say that. I didn't know what was wrong with me. Yeah, hell you didn't, you know. Because I work with a bunch of people right now that I talk to like that. I say, man, you know, I said, you can't snow the snowman. I said, hell, this old man's been around for a long time, you know. So as time went on and came back from the war, my brother, that was what they called 4F. You understand, a 4F was a person that didn't go into the service. It was something that was physically wrong with him. And he had built us a real good business in Dallas, Texas. We had a motorcycle shop, bicycles, lawnmowers, and keys, and a building about this big. Well, it didn't take this brother of mine that I idolized. He came back before I did. It didn't take long for him and I to start drinking this thing up. And one day he came to us and he says, you guys either buy me out or I'll buy you out. I said, well, give me some money, man. I'm out of here, you know. So that was the beginning of my little episodes of going through. Mom had moved to San Diego from Oklahoma in 1945, and she had a home down there. And per usual, I think most of us guys know how we operate as far as mom or our wife or somebody that we were. And the word codependent was one of those things that happened many, many years ago, but just now in therapy they've used it for the last 20 years. But I think that most men know what this codependency thing is. I have always depended on some woman for something. See, that's kind of hard to say, but it's true, you know. Well, a man like an ego like I have has to admit to that thing. But in 43 years of being sober, you'll admit to a whole hell of a lot of things in your life. Yeah. So one day in 1953, by this time my finances had come to a point to where that I could not afford whiskey anymore. So the next step up was Tokay wine. And for the next 12 years, I drink wine. And there's a lot of little things that happened in here that I think most of you'll understand. Now, somewhere in this episode, it was about, I guess it must have been about 6:30, 7 o'clock, and I was sick. I mean, I was really sick. And I know you folks know what that green stuff is that comes out. And it's kind of strangled you, and it's bitter as hell. Somebody's laughing over me. Well, anyway, when this started to happen to me, started really, really getting into as a wino. There's a lot of things that I really didn't want to be, a lot of things that I didn't do. But I came to you folks in 1953, and I was walking down the street trying to find something to drink. Survivors, you know, we're all survivors in this thing, and you have to be a crook to survive the way that I was. You had to be dirty. You had to know how to operate. And sometimes you say, well, I didn't really care. The problem was it was an alcoholic. This alcoholic cared too much. And that was one of the things that really tore me up, was my values. When the way that I was behaving would just tear me up. Well, anyway, when I went to walking down the street, there was a guy that I thought had disappeared. I thought he was dead or something. He'd moved back east or something. And his name was Marvin. And Marvin says, hey, Chief. And I looked around, you know, and I couldn't see anything because I wore glasses most of my life. And if all I could hear a noise, and I'd look all that way, you know. So I went up there, and then I really hated to be dirty. I really hated to be dirty. I hated to walk down the street all wet and with a lump in my pants, you know. But that's the way it happens. I mean, you know, there's no sense in bullshitting about it. I mean, that's the way it is. Well, anyway, he called me in. He says, God, look at your hair. You know, my hair was... See, in those days, you used pomade. You got it, it's almost like lard. You know, and you put it in your hair, and pat it down, you know, and you kind of set your hair, you know. And don't strike a match around it, it'll blow your head up. And it collects dirt. So as we went along, he says, come on in, sit down in the chair. So I got in the chair and he washed my hair. You know, God damn, he said, man, that hair of yours is something else, you know. And of course, he didn't have customers like that, that's for sure. Now, this was the turning point. This was one of the turning points in my life. He says, did you ever think about getting sober? I said, yeah, I thought about it, but that's about it, you know. I never thought about stopping. And, see, that's what Marv had, 3 years of sobriety. God, you know, and he started telling me, he'd been to chair, and I was a captive audience, because he had a razor right here in my butt. And he says, I'll tell you what I'm going to do with you, Chief. Now, another part of this story is I had a wife at the house. I call it a house, not a home. And that's really another side of part of this thing, of the dependency thing. But anyway, he said, I'm going to buy you a couple of bottles of wine, and I'm going to send you home. And he said, I want you to go with me and Ben. There was a couple of old-timers, and they had 8 or 10 years or something like that. And well, Marvin didn't, but Ben did. They were some of the old people that got sober in the 40s, some of these old guys. And sure enough, put me in a cab and send me home, and here's this wife, you know, I'm coming in with a couple of jugs, and she knew the same old crap's going to happen again. So I thought I'll drink all this crap up and get out of there, you know, something. Sure enough, around 7 o'clock, there was a rap on the door, and here was Marv and Ben, and they had, you see these evangelistic people that rap on your doors, you know, trying to save you? Well, this guy had a blue serge suit on. He had white shirt and white socks and with black shoes. I'm looking at these guys and looking over them. So even under the conditions I was at, that wasn't a very good dress. And so I said, well, and they had a book. You know, I used to really mimic those guys because they kind of remind me of some kind of an evangelistic. It was like this. Well, what in the hell do these guys want, you know? Well, we're going to go meet some people. I said, is that right? Well, you said you promised this morning that you'd go with me. I said, okay, let's go. So I went back in the closet and took a big double and got in the car with him. And we go down to a little town called Chula Vista, which is down south of San Diego. And sure enough, we go to this church. And I looked at that thing in the church and I said, holy Christ, now they're going to save my butt. You know, but we went in there, and we went in the back and went down into a split level. And here was people just like yourself sitting in there and standing in there talking and laughing and raising hell. The meeting hadn't started yet, and I didn't understand they had signs all over the place, but I wasn't reading no thing. And the smoke was about to hear with me. And you're like in a fog, and you're looking around, you said, you had to look down. And everybody had a cup of coffee. You know, I never did drink that damn stuff. You know, I always drink wine, for Christ's sake. And I had never seen so many rude people in my life. And I've seen it here happen just when you guys are socializing in here. Now, this man and I could be carrying on a real good conversation, and Bob would walk right up to us and say, butt right in. I'm thinking, what the hell kind of people are these? You know. Under my conditions, I'm condemning these people for their etiquette. Isn't that something? Yeah. Now, this was the turning point. I stayed sober, dry, 9 months. Some way or another, if there's any new people in here, if you're thinking about drinking, get your ass out of here and go get drunk and get ready. If you've got a reservation that you're going to get drunk, you're going to use it. Unless you do some of the things that they taught me to do. You understand what I'm saying? If you're sitting on the fence right now, saying, well, when that old man gets through talking, I'm going to go downtown, and I'm going to do this and do that. Well, maybe you will. But I'm going to leave you with a few things in your head. Because I'll tell you what happens. You're not imbeciles. You're not nuts. So you're going to bring some of this stuff. This is what the psychology of keep coming back means. You're going to get some of this, no matter what it may be. You're going to get some of it in your head, and you're going to take it out of here. So, I was listening to these guys talk, and listening to them talking, and it was almost like a testimony. Is that what they call it in church? And this guy got up and told a real hard story, you know, about this and done that. I'm thinking, hell, this guy hadn't lived. He hadn't done anything like any worse than I have, you know. And but the turning point of it was my head started to clear in 9 months. When one of the old cliches in Alcoholics Anonymous says, bring the body and the mind will follow. How many people recognize that? Okay. They don't say when it's going to follow, does it? But it'll get there over a period of time if you don't drink or don't use. Today we have a lot of dual people that's using anything they can put in their mouth, body, or whatever. Very few real alcoholics left. Very few. Because most people use something besides with it. And not saying that that's too wrong, but it'll get you in the right place right here at night. It got you in here for some reason. So as this thing went on, you know, and this trying to stay sober, trying to stay sober, trying to stay sober. And you done a good job. Because that old saying is, you're sitting in a bar stool and you look at that guy in the mirror there, and you can really take a look at who he is. One of the things you can do. Who is that guy in there? What I do with a group every night, what I do, I have them go look at themselves in the mirror for 2 minutes. When you get a little chance, go in the toilet when you go to your room. Stand there and close the door, because it's embarrassing. And look at yourself for 2 minutes, right in the eyes, right in the mirror, and you won't know who in the hell it is. You won't know who it is. It's pretty good therapy when you start thinking about, who am I? Who am I? Excuse me. You want to share it? I'll let you have the podium, Nick. But anyway, as this thing went along and being sober, I used to wonder, and I'd go to meetings, the guy had 5 years, you know, 10 years. I'm thinking, what in the hell did they do in all that time? 5 years. And, you know, God. Yeah. 5 years. He's sober 5 years. And I didn't believe it. I didn't believe one thing of it. For the next 7 years of my life, from 1953 to 1960, everything that some of those old timers told me was going to happen if I continued to drink started to happen. Some of it had happened before then. But now it seems as though it kind of rushes it on when you have a lot of AA in your head for some reason. And this is part of the story here that and I think some of you guys and gals are going to recognize them. My sister and a little gal was going to church. They were going to nurses training, and I was going with her for a little bit. I don't know what in the hell the matter that woman. Anyway, she was. I'm drunk. Now I'm drunk most of the time, and she said I proposed to her, which I don't think I did. And I don't remember it. Anyway, that old Cherokee mom of mine was sitting in there, and she was talking to her, and she said, if you think that you're going to change that boy in there, because you've got a lot of thought coming, because you ain't going to change him. Well, little did I know, I was going to marry a martyr. God. Now, I didn't know what a martyr was then, you know. But there's things that ring through my ears yet about, well, what about me? Does that ring a bell with some of you folks? What about me? I said, who in the hell gives a damn about you? I said, if you don't like it, go down and see the DA with you. I was too chicken to do that. Well, she finally went down. And here was a real awakening. I'd been working construction, come home dirty, took a shower. And she rapped on the door of the shower. And she said, there's a man out here who wants to see you. So I put a towel around and went out, and he handed me the show cause papers for divorce. And I told him, I said, man, I ought to hug you. I ought to hug you. I said, but that is, you have given me the release that I've been looking for a long, long time. But I don't have to come home and kiss this little woman on the cheek and tell her I love her, which I didn't, because I didn't know what in the hell love was, and pretend like a Nat Hendricks All-American boy. Played the role. So that was the beginning of the end of that marriage. But anyway, as time went on, before this happened, there's a couple of little trips I had. I came home one day, and I had I hooked up with a half pint of whiskey and a bottle of wine. And went to sleep back in the back, in the back bedroom where the kids slept, and this old tomcat of mine. And I heard this neighbor next door say, when my husband was like that, I went to the DA. Man, I jumped up out of that thing. I said, what the hell is she talking about? So pretty soon, here comes a couple of sheriffs, about big as Sam and Al, standing in the doorway. Then we got a superior court order to take you down to the nut house. I said, what? I ain't nut, man. What's the matter with you? He said, we don't know anything about that, but we just got an order to take you over to the county psych ward. And that ain't all that funny, Sam. Like you didn't know. But anyway, when we, I said, well, I got to get my shoes on. I said, they're back there in that closet. See, I had the jug back there. So this big sheriff said, no, I'll go with you. So I went back and acted like I was going to get my shoes, you know, but he stood on the top of them. He said, no, you can't have that. So I go out, and I met one of the kangaroo court. Anybody know what a kangaroo court is? You're screwed before you get there. That's what it is. Yeah. So they sent me out to going to put me on probation. That's where it was. And the significant other, I like that, significant other. The significant other could call the probation department and say, yeah, he's done okay. I'll be drunk in hell over here someplace, you know. And finally, so there was a little bar downtown, and there was a big old heavy velvet curtain, and you had to kind of climb your way through it. And there's a guy coming out, and I was pushing in one way, and I just punched him, you know, and it was my P.O. So he held me up, and he said, well, we're going to take a little ride. I said, okay. So we go back out, and this time he sent me up to San Bernardino, the state hospital. And that's quite an experience. Now, when we got into the steps, the thing that I could not really digest was step two when it talked about restoration or restorative sanity, because that sanity word really got a hold of me some way or another, because I started to recognize that I was a nut. I really started to recognize it. But anyway, I came out at this state hospital, and there was one of the attendants. He says, hey, you get out tomorrow, don't you? And I said, yeah. I said, me and one of the nurses, he said, we're going to TJ to have a little fun. He said, we'll drop you off in San Diego. So he said, I bet you'd have to have a drink, wouldn't you? I said, well, it's a pig's ass pork, you know. And he says, back in the back seat of there was a fifth of whiskey about that long. And he had his football jacket on top of it. And we was waiting on this nut with a piano player. We had a nut with a piano player that was getting out at the same time. And you should have seen some of those dances. But anyway, I took a couple of shots of that. And this guy wasn't fast enough. I said, I'm going in social services and get that joker. He said, no, they'll throw your ass, they'll put another psychosis on you. So I waited, and here he come out of there, you know. He gets in the car, and we head off, and here he had this nurse with him, this, that, and up there. By the time we got from Riverside County into San Diego County, I was drunker than hell, and he was, and his nurse had to drive. And somewhere down there, it started raining before we got home. Well, I told him where I lived, and I didn't live where he had concrete. He had mud. And they kicked my ass out and said, well, we're going ahead. So here I am. I can't even walk. And I'm, this is a big homecoming to my wife. And I'm crawling on this mud, you know, trying to crawl up the steps and rapping on the door. And here she looked down on me like this, and I can just feel what a person would really feel. You know, looking at, this is your husband. And many, many episodes of those kinds of things that just carried on over and over and over. And it finally got to the point to where we bring it up to where this divorce thing happened. And let me give you a little experience of these winos that lived together. There was 15 of us winos lived together after a while. And we had... every one of us had different names. We had the author. Now you can discover the intellect. He had glasses, you know, glasses on, big horner and glasses. And he was always writing something, you know. He's going to write a book about us winos, like Ocean's 11. And he had, and we had Taxi Bob. Now, Taxi Bob was a little grumpy, so I was going to always. And we go out hunting one day, and Taxi Bob says, the author's going to write a story, but he ain't putting my name in there. So we all had guns with us. We got to shooting cans and buzzards and everything else. And he said, I'm going to kill that son of a bitch. I said, what the hell's the matter with you, Bob? You ain't going to kill that poor guy. He don't know what he's doing. So we go back town, and we go in this place where all the Marines and all the sailors meet after work. After get off work, and Bob had his .45 down in there under his jacket. And here was one of these big old television sets that had snow all in it, you know, and this barmaid says, Bob, fix the goddamn TV up there. And he said, I'll fix it, he says. Boom. he shot that television set, and if you've ever heard one of those bugs, one of those things pop, it was all over that bar. And pretty soon there wasn't a sailor or a Marine in that building. There was cops in that building, but there wasn't any Marines. So some of these little stories I'm telling you, there's things that really went through some of my experiences, which would probably go on and on. And guys have asked me, said, why don't you write a book, Nat? And I said, I couldn't know where to start and where to end it, you know. So after this divorce, I started going to meetings there in Riverside, but I still hadn't stopped drinking yet. And I'd been to AA all these years, and we had a little discussion group, and I'd have a bottle of wine up against the building on the outside in the grass, and I'd go in a meeting. And, you know, I had just enough juice in me to start talking, you know. And these guys would whisper, they'd say, that England son just knows all about this AA, but look at him, he's about half drunk. You know. Well, needless to say, this was the nearing to the point where that there was two brothers up there at Modesto, California. You know where that is? Their name was Julio. You know Julio? The last name is Gallo. Ernesto and Julio Gallo. Now, these two brothers were the ones that got me in AA, and they didn't ever know it. But there come that time when all of us, there comes a time when all of us, just in this room, or if you're not, sober yet, that the day of reckoning, so to speak. But I do believe that if you're an alcoholic and you continue to drink, you're going to die. Just that simple. I see it happening. I work with the tribe at Yavapai Apache Nation. And about every 6-7 weeks, we bury somebody with cirrhosis. Some of my clients couldn't tell them. So we look at denial, look at the delusion that we live under. Not only from times that we quit drinking, but the times that we're trying to get well. How many people are under 1 year being sober here? I see your hands. Okay, for the next 3 or 4 years, you're going on a ride that you've never been on a ride before. Yeah. And I really mean that, because I think everybody in here is studying, has got some years in sobriety, knows what I'm talking about. For you, and the you that you would like to be, and the you that really you, is going to clash someplace as you start working these steps. There was a fellow by the name of Keith Moore. He died. He had 11 years of sobriety. He was my first sponsor. Well, Marvin was my first sponsor, but Keith after I moved. And we were sitting around in the back of this tamale factory there in Riverside. And this is the beginning of something that I really advocate as far as the steps are concerned. There were 15 or 16 of us sitting, and he said, I'd like to see the hands of you people that would like to study the steps. Well, how many step study groups have you been to where they just read? They just read, then it kind of drifts into a drunkalog. It's not a step study. So he started this, and he said, well, see, next week, I want everybody to bring a legal pad, and I want you to bring something to write on, because we're going to write the steps. So I said, how long is that going to take? He said, you got all of your life. No, Daddy, that sounds like that's a long time, isn't it? Or it could be. I didn't understand that one point. When we started looking at the powerlessness and the unmanageability of my life, and that was when things started to happen, because now my head is starting to clear, and I can see a little bit about what I was, what I really was, and how the step two fitted in with me being powerless. See, the Seventh-day Adventist brainwashed me when I was younger in school, and they gave me a set of values. They gave me a set of values. Little did I realize that those values were going to be the things that were going to hit me in the face before it was over. Because of my behavior. The conflict was always there. Always there. There wasn't a time that I don't believe, unless I passed out, that I didn't have something that I was guilty over. I had something that I was guilty about. And as time went on, I started to get into this thing. And moved had a little girl that was in. I was running around with her brother who was trying to get sober. And this girl was a metallurgist for Northrop Aircraft. And she said, "Why don't you come down and live with me down in the city of Orange?" Well, hell, I didn't have the money or anything. I said, "Christ, yeah, I'll go." So we went down. I moved in with her down in the city of Orange. And we stayed together for a couple of years. And here's another ego buster. So one Sunday she said, "We gotta talk." And I seen it by the tone of her voice. It wasn't a talk, this is something else. So she says, "You know, we've had a lot of fun together, we've done all this kind of stuff." She says, "But you know what, I can't wait till you grow up." God, damn, you know, it hit me like a mud pie in the face, you know. Because I'm getting to feel pretty good about myself now. But it was one of the things, too, that helped me take a look at what I was. And this personality of mine and how sick that I really was. And I didn't understand how sick I was until probably 7 or 8 years into my sobriety. That I was really holding on to some of the stuff that was embedded in there, that was repressed in there. And that's what the steps are all about. As we get into being able to come to some kind of a belief system. And that was hard for me, the belief system, because I was pretty well indoctrinated with the Adventist church. But I had to create a spiritual thing for me. And the spiritual thing was back to my roots, back to me being Indian. And that's what I've always believed in. I could never follow a dogma of the organized religion. And this thing of me feeling good about myself was starting to take place. And as you take walks and look at the stars and the moon, listen to the birds, grass, flowers, little things that don't mean a hell of a lot to a lot of people, but they meant everything to me, because now the spirit was starting to work and the power was being added to my life. That I could do something now that I had a partner going along with me. And this partner was my higher power. Later on in life, I called him God. And had no qualms about it. But I had an awful lot of qualms about the word God for a long time. And I still can understand why so many alcoholics cannot stand the word God. That's something that's been a mystery. It has really been a mystery why that we, and I'll include you in it, when God was mentioned, when you knew, in some way you kind of recall back, kind of pull back. Is it my selfishness? Is it my self-centeredness? Or is it my little cheap ego that says that I can't depend on anything else but me? And as time went on, that kind of dwindles down. Or we create a dependency, all right, but it's a different kind of dependency. So I used to wonder, as years went by, that is this all there is? And some of you folks, since being new, might be sitting here tonight thinking about that. Isn't that old man talk up there? Is that all it is? I'm going to be going to these damn places forever? Listen to this same old 6 and 7. We all got the same story, just different time and different places. See, if there's anything I know you. Because I know me. And if you're an alcoholic, we're all one. That's the reason it works. When the same higher power works for everybody in this room, even Sam. And that's saying an awful lot, to tell you the truth. No, I love Sam and I love Al. And it's just like old home week. I see my two buddies sitting back here, Merv and Lyle, without to eat. And all of these little tiny things is when you become a part of life. You actually become a part of life. Rather than being a lonely person, and if this lonely disease, it's one of the worst, I think, one of the worst afflictions that a human being can have, is alcoholism and drug addiction. You almost, in your pitch now today, you almost have to put drug addiction in there. Because some of us old timers, they're alcoholic, you know, they kind of feel. You ever been around when they brought the little red flyer out, you know, way back in a little pamphlet? And there was old, hell, some of those guys when I first dated, man, we don't want you in this group. Some guy would come in and talk about him being a drug addict. We get your ass out of here, man. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe you should say it that clear. Just that clean. So then they started all these different letters. What was it? N-A, C-A, I don't know, double A, triple A, whatever. But the reality of it is, it's all in the same boat. The whole damn thing, the whole mess is in the same boat. Every person in this room that's an alcoholic or a drug addict is addicted. If nothing else, you're addicted to yourself. That's the worst kind. You know, I like coming over here. I gave a picture of the second one. I think it was the second. Remember that? I think it was the second one. And there wasn't as many people here at that time. So whatever the council, the committee's doing, it is, and the program itself is growing. And I think now that things are pretty well open as far as the addiction thing is concerned, and you see it everywhere, everywhere. And the greatest thing about it, it's no respecter of men or women. Everybody, when you watch this, watch those Hollywood people who are supposed to be whatever they're supposed to be, they get just as drunk and just as sick as you and I. Anybody. Celebrities, yeah, okay. I could take you down to Laguna Beach and introduce you to about 15 celebrities as far as that's concerned. But they'd be wearing Levi pants with the shoes, sitting there with a t-shirt on. You wouldn't know who in the hell they are. But they're sober, real people. Let me give you one more little thing and I'll sit down. In this little town of Orange, they used to have a little discussion group. And they had these long tables like this right here, and everybody sitting there. Well, they had one over here. Of course, over there, there's a little black-headed lady sitting there. Good-looking little broad, you know. Animal magnetism. You know what that is? The hell you don't. So there she sits over there. Her hair's not black anymore. It's just it's white now, like the rest of us, you know. And that was the beginning of another change in my life. We got married in 1968. She got sober in 1966. Had to give her a couple of years to get her head on straight. You know. Like mine was on straight. But it stood across and something happened. How many of you guys ever, with your wife or girlfriend, ever had that little feeling that this is it? This is it. Well, sometimes that's it and sometimes it isn't. Yeah, it's it. Yeah. Another part of the story was that old Oakey father of mine back there in Muskogee. He was a tough old bastard, I'll tell you. The guy said, "You're just like your old man, you know." I said, "No, I'm not." I could still feel him kicking my butt with that razor strap. A lot of amends making to be done as time went on in my life. A lot of amends making. And the thing that goes back into this whole era of living was that I finally found me a mate. Because there's nothing any lonelier than you know, you guys that are bachelors think, yeah, man, there's nothing like being a bachelor. He's so full of crap, you know. You really, yeah. Because I tried it for about 6 years. And man, I'll tell you, they'd be washing your own goddamn clothes and cooking your own meals and making your own lunch and all that. It just don't work. And, of course, there was a few people dropped in there every now and then. But, so we've had a good life. A good life. Growing up together. See, I was sober a little while before, and I was sober in 60, and she got sober in 66. But that part of the thing, or part of life, was very interesting, and it still is interesting. Now, I think about the times when we have a little heated discussion. You know, and I'll have to look at myself and wanting to be right. You understand what I'm saying? Well, how about her? She wants to be right. What have you got there? You got two people that want to be right their way. Right? Now, what do you do in a married life like this? The old saying is, you've been 50-50, you don't work like that. You don't work like that. So there's times when I had been 110. Yeah. Well, she doesn't bend quite that far, but she bends. So life has been, so it's been one hell of a thing, I'll tell you. Looking at the child, I still work in alcoholism until Monday was my last 40-hour day. See, and I'm 79 years old, for Christ's sake. And the thing of it is, was that I've watched people retire. Excuse me. I've watched old comrades retire. I watch them, they grow, they look at the grass and watch it grow. Yeah, just sit around. You see them walk up and down. Maybe take the trash out every now and then. I used to look at them and say, is that retirement? I don't want no part of that crap. Well, my personality hadn't been like that forever. Ever since I grabbed that first freight train when I was 14 years old, it's never been the same. It's always been doing something. I've worked every day of my life since I was a kid, most of the time. Worked construction. I was damn lazy in construction that I had to get a foreman's job. See? But anyway, I really appreciate the committee for asking me over. Where's Terry? Do I know Terry? Is that you? I was going to say your name. It doesn't look like Terry to me. But I want to thank the committee for asking me over, and my wife. We enjoyed being with you. And let's see. I want to make an announcement for the sobriety convention at the Casino Lodge and Convention Center, July the 16th, 17th, and 18th in Camp Verde. The reason I really want to put it in June, but it's kind of chilly in June yet. So July, if you go, you'll have full access to the pool. But it's going to be damn hot in Camp Verde in July. See? So I want to thank everybody for the attention, and I really appreciate being with you. Good night, now.